Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's Deputy UN Representative Dmitry Polyansky went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February. As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
Tensions between Russia and Israel appear to be on the rise. Israeli media reports say Russian forces have opened fire on Israeli jets with advanced S-300 anti-aircraft missiles. The missiles were fired at Israeli warplanes after they attacked targets in northwestern Syria. The move is seen as a sign of significant shift in Moscow's attitude toward Israel. The unprecedented incident is said to have occurred on Friday night when Israeli jets targeted an area near the city of Masyaf, which killed several people. Israel's airstrikes on targets in Syria are countered by the country's anti-aircraft missile batteries. But this time, however, the S-300 batteries also opened fire as the jets were departing the area.
It is the case that these missiles, the S-300 battery, is operated by Russian military personnel, and that they would not have fired without permission from senior commanders. Okay, this is a break in the normal procedure.
Syria's S-300 batteries are operated by Russian military and cannot be fired without their approval. Israeli media reports claim the S-300 radar did not manage to lock onto the Israeli jets and thus did not present a serious threat to the fighter jets. But this would mark the first use of the S-300s against the Israeli warplanes over Syria. It's not clear whether the S-300 missile fire was a one-time event or if it was a Russian signal to Israel that it was changing its policy.
So this was the first use of it, and it was known to be done by Russian military personnel at Russian military command. But it also, they did not lock the radar on the planes. So the planes were never in danger. It's unclear from the reports whether they couldn't lock the radar on the planes or whether they just didn't lock them and just wanted to throw these missiles up there as a kind of signal and a warning to Israel that, you know, we may change our policy and we may take down some planes.
The development comes amid deteriorating relations between Tel Aviv and Moscow over Ukraine. Israel has backed Ukraine after the war began. Tel Aviv's stance has angered Russia. Russia's latest move against Israel would be a worrying development for Israel.
And that has to do, of course, with the whole reverberations of what's going on with Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians are realizing that and starting to act much more militantly in the sense that they understand this is now a war for the future of a lot of things.
The Tel Aviv regime has repeatedly targeted the positions of the Syrian army and its allies, but has rarely acknowledged or discussed such operations. The aerial bombardment intensified in scale and frequency after 2011, when the Arab country found itself in the grip of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism.
Oh, it will continue. No question about it. Look, it's not going to even think about stopping until a plane goes down. If S-300s or some other effective anti-aircraft defense takes down Israeli planes, then there'll be a problem. So the Russians have signaled something here, and they didn't take down a plane. And until and unless they do, Israel's not going to change its policy on that at all. And even if they do, that would cause a problem for Israel, and they would have to think twice about it.
Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out attacks on the Arab country to aid terrorist groups against the Syrian army. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, calling the aggression a blatant violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. The development comes after warmongering rhetoric of Israeli officials against Iran and its allies. Just recently, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Tel Aviv would prevent Iran from transferring advanced capabilities to its allies in the region. But Iran has dismissed the threats, saying it's determined to help the resistance axis stand up against Israel's aggressive moves in the region.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has visited Albania. Officially, the trip was meant to celebrate the centenary of U.S.-Albania diplomatic relations. But Pompeo's stance against Iran manifested itself after he went to the camp of a notorious terrorist cult there. Pompeo held a meeting with the leaders of the Mujahideen-e Khalq, or MKO, terrorist cult. Encouraged by the presence of terrorists there, Pompeo repeated his anti-Iran rant, expressing his long, unfulfilled wish to see the Islamic Republic overthrown. The former CIA chief said that under the leadership of infamous Maryam Rajavi, the MKO has been laying the groundwork for what he called a, quote, free, sovereign, democratic republic of Iran.
The recent visit of Mike Pompeo to Albania is in a way a revitalization of the old connections that Mike Pompeo has with Israeli Mossad and the Iranian Mujahideen, who are terrorists.
Pompeo is not part of the current U.S. administration, but his rhetoric and deeds indeed reflect the deep-seated animosity of the U.S. establishment towards Iran and its government. During his tenure as the U.S. Secretary of State between 2018 and 2021 in the Trump administration, Pompeo and other belligerent politicians around him, most notably former National Security Advisor John Bolton, expressed an open secret regarding Washington's stance towards MKO terrorist cult. Pompeo and his team became the MKO sponsors in his delusional attempt to overthrow the Islamic Republic. Back then, the regime in Washington left no stone unturned to topple Iran, but failed miserably in the hysteric anti-Iran drive.
Pompeo was paid probably more than $150,000 for his visit to the Mujahideen camp.
Mujahideen-e Khalq is a terrorist cult which is now based at a camp in Albania. The MKO regularly hosts big events in which top American and European officials make speeches in support of the group.
They run a paramilitary camp in the town of Manza in the region of Durrës in Albania. From Manza, the Mujahideens, they carry hostile and terrorist activities against Iran, but even against political Islam in general.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, and former Director of Saudi Arabia's intelligence agency, Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, are amongst the top officials that have attended the group's events. The terrorist cult has been accused of being involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. The MKO was formally designated as a terrorist group around the world, but the United States and the Europeans delisted it in recent years amid growing strains in ties with Tehran. The terrorist group also fought alongside Iraqi forces in the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's war on Iran in the 1980s. Prior to that, it killed thousands of ordinary Iranians and officials, the number said to be in the tens of thousands. Support for anti-Iran terrorist groups in the US and Europe has remarkably grown in the Western countries, with many Western spy agencies actively involved in aiding and arming them.
Well, the US government has a long history of cooperating with terrorist organizations. Nowadays, we have many countries in the Middle East who complain from the US support for different terrorist groups.
The Islamic Republic has already warned Europeans that their support for the MKO will be costly for them. Tehran has condemned the hosting of the group by Albania and is delisting by the US and Europe.
On Saturday, a gunman attacked a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, killing 10 people and injuring three others. Most of the victims were African American, making the attack one of the deadliest racially charged mass shootings in the United States' recent history. According to the police, the detained suspect, identified as 18-year-old Peyton Gendron, drove over 200 miles to carry out the attack. The law enforcement also said they were reviewing a 180-page document published online detailing the gunman's motivations. In the so-called manifesto, the author describes themselves as a white supremacist concerned about, quote, the dwindling white population. The document also says that he chose the area for the attack as its zip code has a large black population, which was within the driving distance of where he lived.
The inability of the unsustainability of neoliberal capitalism. So there's less resources, there's scarcity, there's a job market is being affected. Everyone is affected by that, but their interpretation of what the problem is different. And for white extremists, white supremacist extremists, they blame immigrants, they blame black people, they blame. And so you're seeing these ideologies that are emerging, or mentalities, or not emerging. They've always existed, but they're responding to the intensification of the logical conclusions of neoliberalism and neoliberal capitalism, austerity, joblessness, you know, privatization, all of that.
The police are investigating the attack as a hate crime, as an act of racially motivated violent extremism. The teenager faces first-degree murder, a charge he has pleaded not guilty to. Among the victims were a father who was buying a birthday cake for his three-year-old son, and Catherine Massey, a 72-year-old woman who was known for her civil rights advocacy. The tragic irony is that almost a year ago, she had written a letter to a local newspaper calling for stricter gun control measures. The Buffalo mass shooter managed to live stream his attack on a popular streaming service using camera gear mounted on his military helmet. Although the feed was taken down soon after it began, the issue reignited criticisms about the moderation of social media platforms. It bore striking similarities with the 2019 terrorist attack on two mosques in the city of Christchurch in New Zealand that killed 51 people. That attack was also streamed live on social media. The incident in Buffalo is considered the deadliest mass shooting in the U.S. so far this year. But some 200 other mass shootings were carried out since the beginning of January. Unofficial data suggests that over 320 people are shot in the U.S. every day. A recent report by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that gun violence in the country rose dramatically in 2020, with homicides involving firearms surging by 35%, the highest level in 25 years. The report points to disparities in the rates of homicide based on race, ethnicity, and poverty. This study fails to single out the specific reason for such inequality, but cites the COVID-19 pandemic as a possible socioeconomic driving factor.
People having to seek their own interpretations of what's happening. We're seeing it like things like this shooting, and this is not the only shooting. There's other things that are happening where people are acting out, trying to figure out, you know, just acting out, reactionary, the most extreme reactionary responses to what's happening. And it can only get worse. As long as capitalism and white supremacy and patriarchy are the rule of the day in the United States, they can't address the fundamental human needs of people, then things like this will get worse. And then as the media glosses over it and doesn't want to tell people the truth, they can only get worse.
Tragic incidents like these are a grim reminder of the need for tighter gun control laws that would prevent easy access to firearms and reforms that would rid the U.S. society of racial and ethnic biases.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, keeping secrets and the faults. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the keeping the secrets of our neighbors and their faults. In the Islamic lifestyle, when we look at the rights of the neighbors, and in order to have the Islamic lifestyle, we must keep the secrets of our neighbors if we know something. And also, we must secure or keep the faults of our neighbors or have this secret as well. According to the saying of Imam Zainul Abidin, he has said that وَأُسِرُّ لَحُمْ بِالْغَيْبِ مَوَدَّةِ, that when you keep a secret of your neighbor in their غَيْبَة, which is like when they're not present in front of you and when they're not present, this brings love between the neighbors. This brings closeness and affection between the neighbors. So one of the causes of closeness and the love amongst the neighbors with each other is that they keep the secrets of each other. And on top of that, maybe there are some faults that the neighbor have. Maybe there are some things that they are performing, and it is something which is specific to them. The flaws, maybe the faults or defects, or there is a deficiency in the ethical or the practical life they have. Therefore, it is necessary for a neighbor to keep these secrets with them and do not share it with the people, to help them coming out of the deficiency that they have, to come out of the flaws that they have, and to help them in order to become better, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of keeping the secrets and to keep the faults of the neighbors and to help them in order to fulfill those faults or to cover the flaws that they have, to recover the flaws that they have in their life. So if they have any faults or defects in their life, we must help them. And on top of that, we need to keep their secrets, if they have any kind of secrets, and if we know about them. Why? Because this brings love amongst the neighborhood, and we will have a secure and peaceful neighborhood in this way. When a person knows that if I have any issues and people can keep their secrets or his secrets and the neighbors are helpful, he can have a peaceful life in that area. So therefore, this is one of the necessities that we need to do that. On top of that, this is the right of the neighbors. You know, the way, for example, if my brother or sister has a secret or if they have a fault, I keep them with myself so that it brings affection between these brother and sisters. Or maybe if our kids have any kind of faults, or if they have a secret and they ask us to keep it secretly and to not share it with the others. And when we are not sharing it and we are keeping that secret, obviously it brings a respect in their heart in relation to us. Similarly, when in relation to our neighbors we have the same attitude, it spreads or it brings the respect of each other. It brings the respect and the love in relation to each other. And if we can have such an attitude towards our neighbors, this will bring peace in the neighborhood. This will bring peace in our life and in their life. And also, this is one of the characteristics of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as well, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is Sattarul Uyub. He is the one who hides the faults of the people. Therefore, we, being the follower of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, being the servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, must keep the secrets of the people, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
An unprecedented trove of leaked IRS data shows who reported the most income in America from 2013 to 2018, as well as their tax rates, revealing that the very richest pay lower rates than the merely rich. Stay with us for an article in this regard, published in ProPublica under the heading America's Top 15 Earners and What They Reveal About U.S. Tax System. Here's more. Thanks to an analysis of its unprecedented trove of IRS data, ProPublica is revealing the 15 people who reported the most U.S. income on their taxes from 2013 to 2018, along with data for the rest of the top 400. The analysis also shows how much they paid in federal income taxes, and it demonstrates how the American tax system, which theoretically makes the highest earners pay the highest income tax rates, fails to do so for the people at the very top of the income pyramid. The top 400 earners pay noticeably lower tax rates than the merely rich. And if you include payroll taxes, a married couple making $200,000 a year could end up paying higher tax rates than a person making $200 million a year. Scan the names on the list of the top 15 income earners and you're certain to recognize several names, or at least the names of the companies they founded. Bill Gates hasn't been involved in the day-to-day operations of Microsoft for over a decade, yet he still earned the most during the years experts studied, reporting an average yearly income of $2.85 billion and an effective federal income tax rate of 18.4%. Steve Ballmer, his former colleague, is also a well-known public figure, both for his time as Microsoft CEO and his current ownership of the Los Angeles Clippers NBA team. Ballmer's average annual reported income of $1.5 billion landed him in the 10th spot on the list, and his effective federal income tax rate was 14.1%. The other side of the PC Mac Wars is represented by Lauren Powell Jobs, widow of Apple founder Steve Jobs. Her average reported income of $1.57 billion ranked fifth highest. She paid an effective tax rate of 14.8%. ProPublica sought comment from everyone mentioned in this article. Nobody disputed the numbers cited here. Unless otherwise noted, representatives for people named in this article either declined to comment on the record, or did not respond to requests for comment. Another well-known billionaire sits just below Gates on the list, media and tech mogul and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, with an average reported income of just over $2 billion, paid an effective income tax rate of 4.1%, by far the lowest rate among the top 15. The presence of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, either the first or second wealthiest person in America, depending on the day, won't shock most people. But Bezos' annual reported income during these years of $832 million put him only at number 15. He paid an effective tax rate of 23.2%. As previously reported, Bezos had so little income in a couple of recent years that he was able to pay $0 in federal income taxes in those periods. Tech billionaires dominate the top 15, but hedge fund managers account for a full third of the names on this list, and some of their incomes were just as huge. Most of them paid relatively high effective tax rates, especially compared to most of the tech sector representatives. Hedge fund managers often make their money through short-term trades, which are taxed at a much higher rate than when tech titans cash in on long-term investments. The highest earning hedge funder is Ken Griffin, founder of Chicago-based firm Citadel. From 2013 to 2018, he reported an average income of nearly $1.7 billion, putting him fourth on the list. Griffin paid a tax rate of 29.2% during these years. Israel Englander, co-founder of Millennium Management, paid at a 30.8% rate, while the co-founders of two Sigma investments, David Siegel and John Overdeck, paid tax rates of 31.6% and 34.2% respectively. Some of this variation in rates reflects how people structure their businesses under tax law. Income earned by publicly traded corporations is taxed at the company level. When it's passed on to big shareholders, such as tech billionaires, it can come in the form of dividends, which are taxed at lower rates than ordinary income. By contrast, the income from some manufacturing companies and hedge funds flows directly to company owners who pay taxes on it, resulting in higher effective tax rates on average. Lists of the world's wealthiest individuals are always heavily populated by heirs, ranging from descendants of old money to scions of more recently minted fortunes. Dozens of heirs made ProPublica's list of 400 biggest income earners. Descendants and relatives of Sam Walton, founder of Walmart, claim 11 spots. The DeVos family, heirs to the Amway fortune, also have multiple members in the top 400. Perhaps the best known is Betsy DeVos, who served as U.S. Secretary of Education during the Donald Trump administration. With a reported annual income of $112 million, Betsy DeVos was the 389th higher earner in this period. Much like the tech titans who topped the list, most of these heirs get their income from dividends or long-term investments, which are taxed at a low rate. Their effective tax rates ranged from as low as 10.6% for Betsy DeVos to a high of 23% paid by Walmart heir Tom Walton. Another key way that some top earners reduced their tax liability was to claim significant deductions, often in the form of large charitable contributions. This is particularly true for wealthy investors who are able to make their donations with shares of a stock. Thanks to a generous provision of tax code, they can then deduct the full view of the stock at its current price without having to first sell it and pay capital gains tax. Michael Bloomberg achieved a tax rate of 4.1% from 2013 to 2018 by taking annual deductions of more than $1 billion, mostly through charitable contributions. From 2013 to 2017, he also wrote off an average of $400 million each year from what he'd paid in state and local taxes. The 2018 tax overhaul limited that deduction to $10,000, but also introduced a huge new deduction for pass-through companies that Bloomberg benefited from.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 29, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Quds Day. In the first part of this speech, Imam Khamenei expressed his gratitude for the Iranian nation for their participation in Quds Day. You people of Palestine, you self-sacrificing youth in the West Bank and in the 1948 lands, you who are struggling for God in the Jenin refugee camp, and you, the residents in the Palestinian camps outside of Palestine, are important, sensitive parts and pioneers of the resistance. Greetings be upon you. Know that, verily Allah will defend those who believe. This is verse of Quran, chapter 22, verse 38. But if you are patient, it will certainly be best for those who are patient. Chapter 16, verse 126. But if you preserve patiently and guard against evil, that will be a determining factor in all affairs. Chapter 3, verse 186. And peace unto you for that you preserved in patience.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, how excellent is the final abode? Chapter 13, verse 24. The Islamic Republic of Iran advocates and supports the camp of resistance. It advocates and supports the Palestinian resistance. We have always said this. We have always acted on this, and we have stood by it. We condemn the treacherous move to normalize relations with the Zionist regime. We condemn the policy of normalization of relations. Some Arab governments have asked the U.S. to accelerate the matter of solving the Palestinian issue. If they mean that before the U.S. leaves the region, it should remove any obstacle standing in the way of the Zionist regime, then first of all, they have behaved treacherously and have brought disgrace to the Arab world. Secondly, they have been naive, since this is a case of the blind leading the blind. At the end of my statements, I send my greetings upon the souls of the Palestinian martyrs. I send my regards to their patient families. I send my greetings to the Palestinians who have been taken captive and prisoner, but who resist with a firm determination. I squeeze the hands of our resistant Palestinian groups who have undertaken to carry out an important part of this great responsibility. And I call on the entire world of Islam, in particular the youth, to participate in this field that brings dignity and honor. And our concluding call will be, all praise belongs to Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Chapter 10, verse 10.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
In the Limelight.
Once NSO Group's Pegasus spyware is successfully deployed against a user, it can hack any phone, intercept messages and emails, view a user's photographs and location, and turn the mobile into a remote listening device, allowing an NSO customer to listen in on conversation held in proximity to the phone. We have prepared for you an article written by Stephanie Kirchgassner. The piece is titled Victim's iPhone Hacked by Pegasus Spyware Weeks After Apple Sued NSO. New evidence has revealed that an Apple iPhone was successfully hacked by a government user of NSO Group's Pegasus spyware in December, weeks after the technology giant sued the Israeli company in a US court of law and called for it to be banned from harming individuals using Apple products. A report published on Tuesday, 5th of April, by security researchers at Frontline Defenders and Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto found that phones belonging to four Jordanian human rights defenders, lawyers and journalists were hacked by government clients of NSO, which appear to be Jordanian government agencies, from August of 2019 to December of 2021. The news appears to show that Apple users could still be vulnerable to surveillance by NSO government clients, even after the company sued NSO last November. At the time, Apple said it was filing a lawsuit against NSO and its parent company to hold them accountable for the surveillance and targeting of Apple users. It followed the identification of an exploit by Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto that allowed users of NSO to infect iPhones with the company's Pegasus spyware through a vulnerability in its iMessage function. Apple said at the time that the vulnerability had been patched. The report by Frontline Defenders and Citizen Lab said, "The fact that the targeting we uncovered happened after the widespread publicity around Apple's lawsuit and notifications to victims is especially remarkable. A firm that respected such concerns would have at least paused operations for government clients that have a widely publicized track record of human rights concerns." Jordan's National Center for Cybersecurity categorically denied the findings of the report. It told the Associated Press, "These allegations are baseless and Jordan has not cooperated with any agents with the aim of spying on citizens' phones or censoring their calls." An NSO spokesperson had no comment on the findings, but said that the monitoring of dissidents, activists and journalist activists by any client would amount to a severe misuse of its product. Once Pegasus is successfully deployed against the user, it can hack any phone, intercept messages and emails, view a user's photographs and location, and turn the mobile phone into a remote listening device, allowing an NSO customer to listen in on conversation held in proximity to the phone. NSO has said it investigates serious claims of abuse and that it does not know how its government clients use its spyware. It has claimed Pegasus is only meant to be used against serious criminals and terrorists. Apple did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The report by Frontline Defenders and Citizen Lab named three Jordanian citizens whose phones they said were hacked using Pegasus, including a human rights defender named Ahmad Al-Naymat, who is currently in prison for a case related to protests at Al-Salt State Hospital, where lack of oxygen has killed several COVID-19 patients. The researchers found that human rights lawyer Malik Abu Arabi, who represents Al-Naymat and other activists, was hacked at least 21 times between August of 2019 and July of 2021. A third target, Soher Jaradat, is a human rights defender and journalist focused on women's issues in the media. The researchers found that Jaradat had been sent text messages and WhatsApp messages with links to Pegasus spyware. The researchers said the WhatsApp message impersonated a popular anti-government Twitter user in Jordan. The researchers' findings were peer-reviewed and confirmed by Amnesty International's security lab. The latest news comes as NSO appears to be locked in battle with the managers of Berkeley Research Group, a consultancy that took over management of the fund that owns NSO last year. Berkeley Research Group is engaged in litigation in London with the previous owners of the fund and claim new details about its frayed relationship with NSO. A witness statement filed by Finbar O'Connor, the managing director of Berkeley Research Group in New York, said that cooperation from NSO's management has been virtually non-existent since it began managing the fund that owns the Israeli company. Finbar O'Connor also said that the Berkeley Research Group is still not in possession of information sufficient for it to understand historic actions by NSO that resulted in the Biden administration placing NSO on a Commerce Department blacklist. NSO did not respond to questions about Berkeley Research Group's claims. The charges raise questions about corporate oversight of the company's executive managers in the wake of last year's publication of the Pegasus Project, an investigation into NSO by Forbidden Stories, a journalistic collaboration that included The Guardian. The Pegasus Project reported dozens of cases of individuals who were hacked or targeted by NSO's government clients, including journalists, activists, and government officials. In Finbar O'Connor's witness statement, the Berkeley Research Group executive said that he understood that NSO is undertaking efforts to identify potential US-based investors early in 2021, but that the effort had been halted as a result of the Pegasus Project, which he said negatively impacted investor interest. NSO did not respond to a request for comment in connection to that claim. The company separately faced a new lawsuit in France by a French-Palestinian human rights defender named Salah Hamouri, who, with the International Federation of Human Rights and the Human Rights League, is suing NSO for violating privacy rights in France. An investigation by Frontline Defenders published in November found that the mobile phones of Hamouri, whose Al-Quds residency status has been revoked, and five other Palestinian human rights defenders were hacked using Pegasus, NSO's signature spyware. Frontline Defenders' findings were independently confirmed with high confidence by technical experts at Citizen Lab and Amnesty International's Security Lab, the world's leading authorities on such hacks. At the time, an NSO spokesperson said it could not confirm or deny the identity of government customers, but that it does not operate products itself and is not privy to the details of individuals monitored.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A new list released by British Daily, The Sunday Times, says there are a record number of billionaires in the UK, with the richest 250 people worth more than half a trillion pounds. Released in the middle of a soaring cost of living crisis, this year's list has new entrants, among them a UK government minister and his wife.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, The Sunday Times' rich list. In this country, it says, 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working. And obviously, we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country, amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out, suddenly, out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times rich list bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men. At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Purizap, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden met South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol for summit talks in Seoul Saturday. The conservative Yoon seeks to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Biden's remarks perhaps fell short of the strategic nuclear umbrella the hawkish Yoon seeks, while offering some reassurance regarding North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
Today, President Yoon and I committed to strengthening our close engagement and work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Several demonstrations took place throughout the day outside the summit venue. Peace activists worry Yoon's hasty actions to embrace Washington endanger regional peace and security.
Strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance will likely cause a backlash from North Korea, China,